Now that we'll be trying to transcend the borders of Yeshiva College, the mostly geographical borders, which are artificial anyway. And it's a pleasure to inaugurate this by welcoming Professor Joshua Berman from Bar Ilan. Professor Berman is a lecturer in the Department of Bible at Bar Ilan. He's written a number of books, both on Jewish thought. Some of you might have encountered his early work on the temple, which is a very interesting and meaningful book on the symbolism of a temple, and within the more technical field of Bible and ancient Near Eastern literature, some of his works on literary parallels and literary analogies within the Bible. And his most recent book was published by Oxford a couple years ago, called Created Equal, How the Bible Broke with Ancient Political Thought, which was reviewed all over the place almost exclusively positively, which is really remarkable given the climate of the field of Bible these days. And it's a real pleasure to welcome Professor Berman here today to talk about a subject that's of particular interest to our community, to the Yeshiva University community, engaged both in the study of Torah and also the study of academic Jewish studies. So I'll call Professor Berman up to speak about inconsistencies in the Torah, looking beyond Rav Breuer and source criticism.
Thank you, Aaron. I had an unusual experience this week. What's that? Not quite yet. Soon. We'll get to the handout soon. I gave the title of this talk to Aaron a few weeks ago, maybe two or three weeks ago. And then in the past few days, I got emails from people at Bar Ilan and at Brandeis and at JTS asking me about this talk today, which I take certainly not a tribute to what I'm going to say because no one knows what I'm going to say, but much more to perhaps Professor Kohler's efforts in getting the word out. But perhaps most I think it says something that when someone offers to even dare to talk about how we're going to or what are the possibilities of somehow confronting source criticism of the Torah from an Orthodox perspective, people are interested. What I want to do today, I think that there's potential for a different type of approach than what's currently out there, and I want to try to present this through taking one small corner of the problem as an illustration and sort of dealing with the nitty-gritty of it and then seeing what the larger implications of this might be. I want to speak about the problem of the narratives in Sefer Dvarim. The fact that the first 11 chapters of Sefer Dvarim have several accounts that are in there that seem to parallel earlier events in Chumash, especially in Sefer Shemot and Sefer Bamidbar, and almost across the board we find inconsistencies. Someone might even say discrepancies that cannot be resolved at all. And I want to speak first about what the Masorah has had to say about this and sort of the discomfort that has left some with, and also within scholarship, how scholarship has approached this, and how even within scholarship there is some sense of discomfort with the answers that are being given there. When you look in Mefarshim about how to account for the discrepancies between the narratives of Sefer Dvarim and the earlier narratives, then what you find generally is what I would call a kind of a Johnny at the Dyke approach. Well, yes, this does look to be a little bit different, but you can explain it, you can get out of it by saying this here and that there, and it works. And that's okay if you do that once or twice, but when you just take the first perek, just perek Aleph of Sefer Dvarim alone, if you read it carefully against the parallel episodes or narratives in the earlier parts of Chumash, if you've come up with any less than 30, and that's not an exaggeration, 30 differences between perek Aleph and Dvarim and the earlier stories, then you haven't read closely enough. And if you don't find all 30, I can direct you to the scholarship on that chapter, and that will help you identify all 30. And when you look in the Mefarshim, you find that they deal with maybe about half, only about half of those. Just to give one example of something where, I don't know if I went through every parshan, I certainly didn't, but you go through, you know, the top 10 parshanim, then you find that none of them relate, for example, to the issue that in Sefer Dvarim, Moshe Rabbeinu gives a speech to Bnei Yisrael before Chet HaMeraglim, and then during the episode of Chet HaMeraglim itself, Sefer Dvarim says that Moshe gave them a long harangue, a long tochacha, and you don't find any semblance of this at all in Sefer Bamidbar, where it seems like Moshe Rabbeinu just sort of faded into the woodwork, kind of out of despair, and let Yehoshua and Kalev take over. And none of the Mefarshim try to account for this, and this is without discussing things that are really much more at loggerheads between them. So you have one approach of a kind of Johnny at the dike. You have a Barbanel who says, well, Moshe Rabbeinu deliberately changed things. He goes in a different direction, and he changed things because he didn't want to scare Am Yisrael. He was afraid that, for example, if he had really told the truth, that sending the Meraglim was a Kadosh Baruch Hu's idea, then they would have said, oh, well, look how that turned out, so why should we follow the Ribbono Shel Olam anymore? So deliberately there are changes, says the Abarbanel. It's the kind of thing that only Abarbanel has the guts to ever say, but even that doesn't account for anything. And so even if somehow we were to go through all of the differences that we find between the narratives of Sefer Dvarim and the earlier Svarim, and manage to do the Johnny and the Dyke approach, no, it's not really a theory. You can get out this way, you can get out that way. The question at the end of the day still remains, why are we having to do all this acrobatics? Or I'll put it a little bit differently. Why is this a feature that is specific to Sefer Dvarim? Okay? That is, we're not talking here about Shmuel and Malachim on the one hand and Divrei HaYamim on the other. Normally, throughout the Tanakh, when there is a reference back to a previous episode, it's more or less correct. It seems to more or less jive. But in Sefer Dvarim, wholesale, across 11 chapters, you have all of these inconsistencies. Well, of course, diachronic or source critics would say, well, that's because you need to come over to our side of the fence. And then we have a simple answer. We have multiple authorship, and you have an author of Deuteronomy who has a different version of events. But even within the academy, and even within those that adopt source criticism as an approach, there is a sense of discomfort with this approach for the following reasons. First of all, at many junctures in these stories in Sefer Dvarim, Sefer Dvarim says, it's Moshe speaking to the people saying, and ba'etahi this happened, and ba'etahi that happened. In other words, it's cast as, we all remember that earlier story. So that Sefer Dvarim makes a very clear effort to present itself as having continuity with something that came beforehand. If this truly is just a different version of all the stories, or a snippet of that, so why does it have that sense of continuity that Moshe is saying, you know, we all remember what's going on here? Or why is it that Sefer Dvarim seems to assume that you know the previous stories? For example, it speaks about how Kalev he did well at the Chet HaMeraglim, and therefore he gets his reward. But Sefer Dvarim never talks about what Kalev did well. It seems to assume that you know the earlier narratives. So this is a challenge for source critics who wanted to say, well, no, we just have totally different, independent versions of what happened, and the author of Sefer Dvarim had zero interest in you knowing what the author of Bamidbar or Shmot or P or J or whatever that might have been. No, this does seem to be some attempt at continuity. But perhaps the greatest question that source critics are still asking themselves is, okay, let's assume that there was a separate author for Deuteronomy, and he had a different view of things. Why is it that the final product that has come to us holds the two together? Wouldn't you have expected that a final redactor would smooth out the differences? Indeed, as the author of the Samaritan Pentateuch did. The author of the Samaritan Pentateuch saw some discrepancies, and he didn't like that, and so he tried to smooth things out. Perhaps not all of the discrepancies that are there, but one would have expected that somehow someone would have said, hey, this doesn't jive, and so therefore we need to try to smooth it out. And one final difficulty I think that many scholars have who adopt a source critical approach is that it's difficult to see what is the agenda of the putative author of Deuteronomy in changing the stories. Because when you look at overall what is the character of the stories in Dvarim relative to their parallel stories earlier in Shmot and Bamidbar, about the only thing that one can say is that the accounts in Sefer Dvarim are more critical of Am Yisrael than, more sharply critical of Am Yisrael, than the earlier accounts that you find elsewhere in Chumash. But it's very difficult to find something that, oh, this must be Greek in 3rd century or 7th, or whatever. It's very difficult to find an agenda in the way in which the stories are crafted. So all of these things together have led, I think, both within the Masorah, there's still some questions that come up about why we have all of these differences, and as I say as well, for diachronic or source critics, not everything seems to have been solved. And again, even for source critics, why do we find this phenomenon solely in the book of Deuteronomy? Why don't we, if this is something that's just true about how stories were written and constructed and edited, then one would have expected this to happen much more broadly. So both for the Masorah and for scholarship, I think what we need to define is that this seems to be a particular issue about Sefer Dvarim. Okay? Now, my approach this afternoon, and one which I think which has enormous, enormous potential, both for scholarship and for B'nai Torah and for our own reflections on the theological meaning of inconsistencies in the Torah, there is enormous potential in engaging in much greater detail than we have until now. I say that both for B'nai Torah and also for the scholarly world, with ancient Near Eastern texts, ancient Near Eastern ways of thinking, ancient Near Eastern ways of writing. And I think that one way to get a handle on inconsistencies in the Torah, particularly the narratives at the beginning of Sefer Dvarim, is by engaging a certain corpus of material from the late Bronze Hittite Age. And what I'm going to share with you now is something that I've written up as an article, and it's, Mirza Shen, it's going to be appearing in the Journal of Biblical Literature in about a year's time. Some of you may be familiar with the parallels that scholarship has come up with between structures, the structure of the Torah, particularly the structure of Sefer Dvarim, and the late Bronze Hittite Treaty. Now, what I'm going to do now is the following. I want to sort of quickly go through what's been said over the last 50 years about this. It's really cool stuff. I just find it really cool stuff. And then I want to take it a little bit farther from what's been already put out there. So we're going to be talking about Hittites for quite a few minutes now. Nothing having to do with Torah, everything having to do with Hittites, but this is the way you have to do it. You really have to get into the nitty-gritty of what goes on elsewhere, understand it well, and then see maybe if you can come back and say, ah, now I understand what's happening here in the Torah. Okay? So this is the basic vort here about treaties. About 1955, a scholar named Mendenhall noticed that the stuff that had been dug up from the ancient Hittite Empire, which is modern-day Anatolia, Turkey, revealed that they had a lot of political connections between the powerful Hittite kings and what are called their vassal kings, which were subservient to them. This is a type of relationship which is not intuitive to us today. Today, all relationships that we have, whether they are interpersonal, whether they are between states, are parity. That means equals. Countries come together, they sign a pact, an economic pact, a military pact. People come together to sell a car for employment. We do so as equals. In the ancient world, there was a different type of relationship called a vassal treaty relationship. What would happen would be the following sort of thing. You would have a political environment where you had strong states. Hatti, or the Hittite kingdom, was a strong state, surrounded by a bunch of weaker states in the Levant, northern Syria, and Ugarit. And what would happen is that when one of these weaker states would find itself in straits, it could be because of drought, it could be because of being under siege, then the weaker state would send out an SOS. They would send an ancient email to the Hittite kingdom saying, SOS, save me, we're dying here because of famine, we're surrounded by an enemy, come and save us. And the Hittite kingdom would send food if it was a drought, or armies if it was a siege, and they would bring deliverance to the lesser state, the smaller, weaker state. What was then understood by all parties involved is that chesed costs, that nobody does this for free. The Hittite kingdom weren't doing this out of a sense of tikkun olam or chesed or anything. They were doing this because they wanted to get a good deal. And the good deal that would result would be that the lesser state would understand, well, now I have to be a vassal, that's what we call it in the literature, to the stronger Hittite state. What does it mean to be a vassal? It does not mean that you now come tarred and feathered and have to bow down and give up all your riches. Rather, what it meant, and we're talking now about the 14th, 13th century BCE, we're talking about times that can fit within a conventional dating for, a traditional dating for Yetziat Mitzrayim. It would mean to engage in partnership in a non-equal way. There would be the superior king, the king of the Hittites, and there would be the junior king, lower king, vassal king, one of these smaller states, and they would enter into partnership. And there would be treaties that would be drawn up that would delineate what the responsibilities were for each side. Okay. Now, just before I go on, I see here there are colleagues present, who I know this stuff inside out, and I suspect there are others who it's the first time in their lives that they're hearing about Hittites, and you know, I mean, it just reminds me, I once went, sorry, I have to bring in a little story. I was once in a Chabad camp for a summer when I was in college. I was like a madrich in a kiruv camp. And, you know, we all know the minhag of college students to write the names of their universities in Hebrew letters, you know, on their t-shirts, you know, so Harvard, you know. So this, there was one fellow who had the poor mazel. He attended Emory. Okay, think of what happens when you write Emory on a t-shirt in front of a bunch of Chabadnikim. So like, they, oh my gosh, like they had never seen, you know, Emorim before in their life. So Hittites. Now, I want to say, and I feel it's really important because I wanted to address the audience today, both academically but also religiously. Like, why should we care about Hittites when we're talking about the Torah? So I just want to bring one source, and hopefully it'll give me enough religious cover. The Ralbag, at the beginning of Parshas Pekudei, asks the famous question, why do we have all of these repetitions from Truma and Tetzaveh again in Vayakal and Pekudei? Wouldn't have been enough to just say Vayaskein? And the Ralbag says, you know, I went through all the answers that have been said until my time, and I don't find them particularly persuasive. And then he says, you know what? It could be that what we find repetitious and therefore unesthetic and imperfect, that's our own Mishagas in our time. But it could be that when the Torah was given, that aesthetics were different, and the way of speaking and writing at the time was different, and the Torah speaks the fei min ha-makom at the time. Okay? And that's very important, because that's exactly what I'm saying. That many things, and I'm sure that the Bible professors here routinely teach this, but again, I want to be, as we say in Hebrew, liyasher kav, to get everybody on board with what I'm doing. What I'm stating is that Dibre Torah k'lashon b'nei Adam, and that lashon b'nei Adam is not universal always, but there was a specific lashon b'nei Adam at the time, and I want to say hello to my good friend and mentor, Professor Eichler, Tzarayim Tovim. So that what my religious foundation point here is that there's no problem at all with saying that the Torah takes ways of thinking and writing from the ancient world and uses that as the basis for how it constructs the relationship between a Kadosh Baruch Hu and Am Yisrael. Now, going back to Mendenhall and the Hittite treaties, what Mendenhall noticed is that when you go through, and there are about 20 of these treaties that we have in our possession between the Hittite kings and their vassal kings, is that the treaties tended to have a fairly stable form, and there were about 5 or 6 elements that were consistent every time the Hittites drew up one of these treaties with one of their vassals. The first thing would be an historical prologue. That means, and we're going to talk mostly about this one today, that would mean that the treaty would begin by delineating the story that led to the smaller state becoming a vassal to the stronger state. What was the Yeshua? What was the deliverance that the king of Hatti offered to the smaller state? That would be the first part, an historical prologue. The next part that was typically found in these treaties were the stipulations, i.e., what are the terms of vassalage? What are the things that the vassal now has to do for the sovereign, whether it's pay taxes, whether it's send troops, whether it is to turn over people who incite against the king of Hatti, and also what does the king of Hatti have to do for the vassal? When does he have to save him? Under what conditions? Then you would have things about the treaty tablets, laws or stipulations about the treaty tablets. Where do you put them? I.e., you have to take your treaty tablet and put it in your temple. That might sound familiar to some of us. There would always be blessings and curses. And that's very appropriate for this week's Parsha, which is exactly blessings and curses. And then you would have witnesses. Just like we have in Ha'azinu, Ha'azinu HaShamayim V'Adabera, V'tishma Haaretz Imrei Fi, then there would be all sorts of witnesses. Divine witnesses, okay, they believed in Avodah Zarah, but the idea that there were witnesses. Just to bring home a couple of examples that so what Mendenhall claimed is that this, we kind of have this in a lot of places in the Torah. For example, you can see this going from Shmot through the end of Vayikra, pretty much. You have the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. You have the stipulations, which are the mitzvot. You have what we do with the Luchot Habrit. We put them in the Mishkan. You have then many more stipulations along the way, all the mitzvot that we have in Shemot and Vayikra. You have blessings and curses in Parshas Bechukotai. Okay, and then you have all over again the same thing in Sefer Dvarim. You start with the stories at the beginning of Sefer Dvarim, then you have the mitzvot, and there's discussion there about what Moshe did with the luchot, you have Enki Tavo, blessings and curses, and then at the end you have Hazinu, you have witnesses. Just to give a couple of examples of how this really gets down to the nitty-gritty, in some of these treaties, the Hittite king says to the vassal, I want you to come and visit me, visit my court. I want you to come and see my face. I want you to come and see my face. Lirot et panai. Right? As in Shalosh Mimushana Yere Kol Skrucha et Pneha Adon. So it's clear from that what's happening in Aliyah L'Regel is that we are being called by the sovereign king as vassal kings to come and visit his court. And there we are accepted as honored guests. The vassal king is sometimes told, you have to read these treaty tablets from time to time, as in Vishinantam Levanecha V'dibartavam, or perhaps as the mitzvah of Hakel, that you have to read or have read before you these treaty tablets. By far and away, in my humble opinion, the strongest parallel between the Hittite material and what we have in the Torah, this is something that I published in JBL this past spring, is that when you look in Dvarim Perek Yud Gimel, at the parshiot that we call in Chazal speak, Mesitu Mediach and Irni Dachat, right? It turns out that line for line, this is patterned after a 15th century Hittite treaty. What does that mean? They didn't believe in a Kodesh Baruch Hu. That's true. But what they say there, the Hittite king says to the vassal, listen, if anybody in your family, whether it's your brother or your sister or your half-brother or your half-sister, tries to convince you to go follow another king, then you must kill them. Lo techase alav. That exact phrase in Hittite. You must not cover them up or cover up what they've done. Exactly what we have in Mesu Mediach, but the idea is taken from the realm of politics, and now we're speaking about incitement vis-a-vis HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The next se'if, the next paragraph in that treaty says, and if you have a whole city that has incited against the king, then you must wipe them all out, and you must not consider that to be too difficult for you to do, and this is what we have in Irni Dachat. Okay? So there are a lot of parallels here, and it's I think, tremendously enlightening of a lot of little details. What I want to speak about now, everything I've just said is out there in the scholarship. Those of you that are familiar with the scholarship have been very bored the past 2 minutes. But now, what I want to say is something, hopefully, for even those that are not, that are familiar, I want to speak mostly of this element of the Hittite treaty, the historical prologue. Look, everything else that's on the board is pretty typical of any contract that you have. Every contract has stipulations in it. You know, that's the goof of the contract. What do I have to do for you? What do you have to do for me? Every contract has, not curses, but there are repercussions for breach of contract, and every contract has either witnesses or is notarized. So stipulations and curses, i.e. repercussions for breach of contract and witnesses, this is true of treaties throughout the ages. But what is this all about? Why did they begin their treaties with this historical prologue, i.e. telling the story of what it was that had transpired so that the lesser state took upon itself vassalage and submission to the Hittite kingdom? Just to give an example of how strange this is, imagine if we had the standard form of a ksuba. Okay? Ksuba has the stipulations in it, and it has what the responsibilities are. Imagine if every ksuba started with, and now we're going to tell the story of how Yossi met Sara Bela at Hask, and what went on from there, and on and on. It would be very romantic, but you'd say, when a couple talks, they talk about how we met, and blah, 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 blah. But that has no place in a ksuba, because a ksuba is a contract. Or, I just bought a house. We just moved into a new house last week, and I have now left my wife behind in a great act of shalom bayit, and leaving her behind to unpack the boxes. That's not original by me. Now, in that contract, you know, I bought the house from a neighbor who I've known for 15 years, and a man I love dearly. We have a very wonderful relationship. But that's not in the contract. It just says my name and his name, or, you know, he and his wife and me and my wife. And there's nothing there about, oh, we met in shul, and he heard my drushas, and I like him because for these reasons. That has no point. Has no place in the contract. No contract has a whole story at the beginning, a whole megillah, if you will. And so this is a challenge for Hittite studies. And I know I'm going way off field, but all this is really important in the end for us to understand the discrepancies between Sefer Dvarim and the earlier Svarim. Got to bear with me. There's no other way to do this. We've got to go into the nitty-gritty. Why did the Hittite kings write the whole story of how the vassal took upon himself vassalage in the first place? What were they trying to do? What was the purpose of that? Okay. This is what I want to address. This is an issue out there in Hittite studies. No one, I think, has really found a satisfactory answer for it. And la'aniyut da'ati, I'd like to propose something, and you can be the judge of whether it makes sense. Around the time that these treaties are being drafted, we have elsewhere in Egypt a wonderful cache of materials called the Amarna letters. These are letters, correspondences, between the Egyptian king, the pharaoh at the time, or the pharaohs at the time, and his vassals, right? Because just like the Hittite kingdom in the north was very strong, the Egyptian kingdom in the south was very strong. And the king of Egypt had many vassals, including here in Eretz, or here, sorry. I got off the plane this morning. There, Nes Gadol Hayasham, in Eretz Canaan, in Ashdod, in Ashkelon, and other places. And it's a cache of about 300 letters that are written, almost all of them are to the Egyptian court, from the different vassals that are around. And they make fascinating reading because they're so petty. They're so petty. What would happen is that a relationship would be built, and after that, both sides would constantly be wondering, did I just sign on to a deal that I'm going to get stabbed in the back? How do I know that that king, whether I'm the vassal or whether I'm the sovereign king, whichever side I'm on, how do I know that now that we've shaken hands, how do I know the other side is going to be loyal and faithful to me? How do I know that if they're attacked first and I send troops to guard him, how do I know that tomorrow when I'm attacked that there's going to be the reciprocity that I hope for? This was a great concern. It's a great concern of countries today. It's a great concern of businessmen today. It was a great concern back then. And so what they would do to try to sort of make sure that there would be this reciprocity is that there would be a constant exchange of letters. Because remember, there's no email, there's no news. So you constantly wanted to feel the pulse of what was happening from the other side. One way of doing this was a constant exchange of gifts. I send you gifts, you send, like playing ping pong with gifts. Gifts, 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 gifts. Gifts, gifts. If we keep exchanging gifts, and they're good gifts, then I can feel ragua. Then I can feel relaxed that maybe I really do have a solid treaty partner there. Most of these correspondences are about, you call this a gift? I'm not exaggerating. You know, the gold here isn't worth the fleas of 100 camels. That's how they speak. Or there's one correspondence between a Hittite king we're going to see here. A Hittite king writes to the Egyptian king. He says, Egyptian king, I just got a letter from you. This is Amarna number 42. I just got a letter from you, and I noticed, O Pharaoh, that there's two lines. In line number one, your name appears, and in line number two, my name appears. And your name appears exactly above my name. And who's going to be responsible for the next war between us? And what am I, a dead corpse? I mean, the pettiness is just unbelievable. Now, what we see going on here is that there is a tremendous amount of what I would call diplomatic signaling in these letters, a constant desire to prove to the other side that I am loyal to you, or to prove to the side that I'm a tough guy and you have to treat me right. This is very much in the spirit of the times. You have it even today. You have it even today. I mean, just a few months ago when the Prime Minister of China, came for a visit to the White House, I read an article that the White House was like all astir. Would the room in which the dinner was being held, would it be large enough? Would it be at least as big as when he last came under Clinton? And would Obama's remarks about China, would there be enough laudatory remarks quantitatively relative to the last time? So that these things play a very, very significant role in the relationships between states. And if you're not a state yourself, then you can think of it, you know, kind of like a couple going out, you know, did he say enough nice things today, you know, and why not? All these things are being very much measured. This is the game of diplomatic signaling. I want to claim, in my humble opinion, that this is what's going on here. In the historical prologue, what you have here is you have a strong state and a less strong state. If the imbalance was huge, as it would be later in the Neo-Assyrian period, Or if you want to think of a more contemporary parallel, the Nazis and their partners all over Europe, when one side is hugely powerful and everyone else is just a schmata, then you don't need the niceties of diplomatic signaling and licking up and saying nice things. You say, I'm here, you do what I want, I squash you. Okay? But in the 14th century, 13th century BCE, the Hittites are strong, but not so strong. They're looking to forge alliances. So what they're doing in the historical prologue is saying, okay, now we're going, as we're starting out on this new relationship, me, I'm the sovereign, you're the vassal, senior and junior partners, I'm going to give you my version of the story of what happened here. Why? Doesn't everybody know the facts? Yes, everyone might know the facts. But in telling over my version of the story, essentially what I'm doing is I'm signaling, I would say, a balance between carrot and stick. Because we have to explain how it is that you came to be a vassal to me. So if I want to radiate strength and that I feel that I have the upper hand and that you really need to be grateful to me, then I'll tell the story in that way. You were nothing. I came to your rescue. Your entire life is dependent on me. If I do that too strongly, you might get a little annoyed. Hey, where's my honor? So there's always a game here that the stronger king, these texts are always written by the stronger kings, the stronger king has to spin out the narrative in a way that is laudatory enough to the vassal, but without making the strong king seem too weak. That's on one side. On the other side, if he comes off saying, you were nothing, you were a shmata. Well, they probably didn't have shmatas back then. You were a shmata, and your entire existence, you are a dead dog, that's a term they do use, is entirely dependent on me. I might offend you. So I have to figure out how I tell the story to you in a way that properly balances what I think you need to hear about whether I am lording over you or whether I am complimenting you. Okay, it's the same as in politics with everything today. It's exactly the same. When you have an employee, you know, you have to radiate a certain degree of strength on the one hand, but you also have to compliment on the other hand. If you always compliment and never radiate strength, they walk all over you. And if you're just, you know, constantly walking over your employees, then they walk out on you. It's the same thing, okay? Politics is politics is politics. And that's what these stories are about. They have very little to do with what necessarily happened. It's much more, okay, now that we've all agreed that the weaker state is going to join forces with the stronger state wants to make sure that that has good cement. And so we tell the story in a certain way. Okay? Now, what has this got to do with Sefer Dvarim? What I want to do now is, it's time now for our handout. Zeb, this is my friend Zeb. I signed his parents' tuba. Here we are. Please hand that.
Is there a story?
And there was no. Well, I could tell you the whole story, but it's not in the ketubah, Zeb.
Yeah.
Okay. Here, we're going to hand these out here. Hmm. Okay. While the handout is going around, I am reminded now of a story that of a story about Nechama Leibowitz. I once had the schus of taking a course with Nechama Leibowitz, and she you know would walk into a class with a machine gun and gun down everybody. No matter what they said, it was like ridiculous, and you're not thinking. And what happened to you this morning? Once she walked into a class, and she walked to the front. She was quite old. She walked slowly. She got to the front of the class. Class hadn't started, and she walks in like this, and she goes, and we're thinking, what have we done? The class hasn't even started yet, and we're already up the creek. And she turns around, and she says, when I made Aliyah in 1932, I had two wishes. My first wish was that I should merit to live, to be old enough to see the founding of a Jewish state in the land of Israel. And my second wish was that every time I would walk into a class, that there would be chalk and an eraser at the board. Thank God one of these has come to be. There's no eraser here, so I can't erase what I've done. Are there any? Oh, the dean is going to take care of eraser. Okay.
I would ask if anyone has a tissue, but now that the dean is going in, it's going to be, let's see. Okay. Okay. Okay.
You see, you all have experience of that problem.
Okay. All right. What you have in the handout before you are two historical prologues. There's treaties, and I want to look at each of these, and they're the key for what I want to say about the inconsistencies in sacred writing. What we have here is that we have Hatti, the king of the Hittites, up here in Turkey. We have here the Taurus Mountains. Here's the coast, and we have a lot of little states here. Okay. One of the most important states that comes up in these in this material is a little state called Amuru. And Amuru is very important. It's right here on the coast. It's very important because at this time, the rival is Egypt down here. And Amuru is very good at playing the game of one day siding with the Hittites and one day siding with the Egyptians. They go back and forth. So that the border really between Egypt and the Hittites is somewhere around here. Now, I want to read the historical prologue here, which you have from what's this text that's called CTH 49. What the background to this is that all of these little states here have decided to join forces against the Hittites. Bad news for the Hittites. At that time, Amuru had been a vassal of Egypt. And apparently what happened is that Amuru decided to break with Egypt and join with the Hittites at precisely the time that all these other little states were ganging up against the Hittites. Okay? Let's look at what it says here. So, the Hittite king, whose name is longer than this lecture allows time to pronounce in full, Shupiluliuma, he says to the vassal king the following. Previously, the king of Egypt, the king of the land, all these lands here, these are all these lands, I'm not writing in the names here, but the king of Egypt, the king of the land of Hurri, the king of the land of Ashita, the king of the land of Nuhashi, the king of the land of Nia, the king of the land of Kinza, the king of the land of Mukish, and Aleppo, and of Carchemish, all of these kings suddenly became hostile to my majesty. As I said, they were all ganging up against the Hittites. But Aziru, king of the land of Amuru, came up from the gate of Egyptian territory, meaning you broke your alliance with Egypt, and became a vassal of my majesty, i.e. me, king of Hatti. And I, majesty, great king, accordingly rejoiced very much. Did not I, my majesty, great king, accordingly rejoice very much? As I to Aziru, because Aziru knelt down at the feet of my majesty and came from the gate of Egyptian territory and knelt down at the feet of my majesty, great king, took up Aziru and ranked him as king among his brothers. Okay? This is the historical prologue to the treaty that's established between Shupiluliuma and Aziru. What's important to me is to get a sense of the tone and tenor of what's being said. What's being said here is, yeah, you became a vassal to me, but I'm really the one that's grateful to you. You know, I mean, everyone was ganging up against me. All of these were joining with Egypt against me. And you came up, and he says twice, did I not rejoice? Did I not rejoice? So it's clear that the king of Hatti, in this historical prologue, is trying to project to this vassal, Amuru, we're buddy-buddy. I love you, and you can trust me, and I'm so indebted to you. Therefore, it's worthwhile for you to be a good ally of mine. Okay? This is one type of prologue. Why do I bring this up? Because what happens subsequently is that the relationships between Hatti and Amuru go on for another four generations. And every generation, by generation I mean, we're all Basar Vadam, and Admei Avasrim, so what would happen is that whenever one of the kings of Amuru would pass on, there would be a need to renew the treaty between Hatti and Amuru. And this goes on for four times. This is the initial treaty, which is this one, CTH 49, and then subsequent treaties. And what's fascinating, and now we're slowly coming back to things that are relevant for Sefer Dvarim, what you see is that every time the kings of Hatti and the kings of Amuru would renew the treaty, they would again tell the story of how Aziru, that's the king of Amuru here in this treaty, how it was that Amuru became a vassal to the Hittite kingdom. They told that in the second generation. And then in the third generation, when they said, well, let's tell the story again. And then let's tell the story again. The story is retold first and then another three times afterwards. And every single telling of the story is different. Just to highlight this for in the confines of the time we have here, this is the third iteration of the story. And let's look together at how different it is. Okay, so this is a treaty between, for our purposes here, a later king of the Hittites and Bentashina, a later king of Amuru. This takes place at a time when, as I said, Amuru would go back and forth. In the meantime, Amuru had kicked the bucket with Hatti and had gone back to Egypt. And now fortunes had changed again, and Amuru now wanted to come back to the Hittites. So look at how the story of the first couple, of Aziru and Shupiluliuma, is now presented. So the Hittite king says, in the time of my grandfather, Shupiluliuma, Aziru, king of the land of Amuru, revoked his vassalage to Egypt and fell at the feet of my grandfather, Shupiluliuma. My grandfather had compassion for him and wrote a treaty tablet for him. He wrote out the borders of the land of Amuru, of his ancestors, and gave the tablet to him. The story here is different than the initial story. It's the same story about how Aziru became a vassal to Shupiluliuma, but many things are different. For example, in the first story that we saw, the king of the Hittites says, I rejoiced, I was so happy that you were here. It's almost like you're doing me the favor. But no, in this story, it's told, my grandfather had compassion for him. In this story, it's told about how what the king of Amuru did was so extraordinary because Egypt and all these other lands were going to attack the Hittites. But in this story, there's no sense that all the rest of this was going on. This is far more laudatory to the king of Amuru. This is far more, I'm doing you a favor, to the king of Amuru. Okay? It's a very different take on the same story. Why is it written differently? Because the whole purpose of telling the story is to engage in diplomatic signaling. At this time, what the Hittite king wants to signal to this guy is, you're a shmata. And because I think you're a shmata, I'm going to retell the original story as if your great-grandfather was a shmata too. Because that's what fits me now. Those are the needs of the moment. And I can recraft history and tell it a little bit differently and in ways that just don't jive. But that's how we do it. Because the purpose of writing history is really not to get at what really happened, as von Ranke said, the famous German historian. The purpose of talking about history is, how am I going to build the relationship now with you according to the needs that I have now? Now, so what we have here in the meantime is just two versions of the same story. But what is critical, and this is what's going to bring us all the way back to Sefer Dvarim, is that in this treaty, the second one, the Hittite king says, you know what? I'm going to write for you a treaty that is exactly like the treaty that your great-grandfather got. Go and check. You can read it for yourself. And he did that, because we know that all the stipulations in this treaty match all the stipulations in this treaty. Which is to say that this Bentashina, this king of Hatti, this king of Amuru here, had a copy of this treaty. They all had copies. These things never went to waste. Archives were scrupulously kept. And scribes were constantly comparing the earlier treaties with the later ones. Now, that would mean that Bentashina would read the original story of how Aziru had become a vassal to Shupiluliuma. And he would have seen that there were some discrepancies there. This is deliberate. This is deliberate. Why? Because in diplomatic signaling, what's always important is not just what's said, but in the context of what had been said before. Let me give an example. If the spokesperson for the State Department says, the military option is still on the table, let's say regarding Iran or anyone else, the military option is still on the table, what does that mean? Well, it all depends on what he said the week before. If the week before he had said, we are sending the 7th Fleet to the region, and this week he says, the military option is still on the table, that's much more muted. That's like, okay, you know, we're still there, but we're taking our foot off the gas pedal, right? Things are much more moderate. If the previous week the spokesperson had said, all options are on the table, and this week he says, the military option is still on the table, then that's ratcheting it up, okay? What's meant to happen here is that when the king of Hatti writes this unfavorable account of the story, the original story, this king of Amuru is looking at this original story and he sees that difference. He's meant to say, uh-oh, I'm no longer as held in favor and esteem as was my grandfather in his time. They're two different stories, but they're meant to be read together. Okay? I can't emphasize enough how much we know about archives in the ancient world. The Hittites kept many copies of all their treaties. And we know from Ugarit that they also kept their copies of their treaties with the Hittite kingdom. All the kings did this. Why? Because anytime you got a correspondence, a diplomatic correspondence, the only way to really make sense of it was within the context of what has been written until now. And so to sum up what we have here is that you have a running correspondence over many generations between the king of the Hittites and the king of Amuru. And every time they're retelling the story of the initial vassalage between the king of Amuru and the king of the Hatties, they're telling it in a different way. And they're always rereading all of the different versions as they go along. And no one ever challenges. There's not a single scrap of evidence from the ancient world whenever these stories are told that the vassal says, no, last time you told it differently. That's not the way the story goes. No, because no one's really interested here in what the historical facts were. The question is, oh, if you're speaking about me that way, then you must think that I'm a nothing. Or I must really be in deep trouble with you. Okay? And this, I want to claim, is what's happening in the Torah as well. What do we have? We have that this treaty formulation of having historical prologue, stipulations, witnesses, blessings and curses. You go through a first cycle of that from Shemot through Vayikra. Then you have a second cycle of it within Sefer Dvarim as well. It makes sense that Sefer Dvarim opens by retelling these stories. The entire purpose of retelling stories is to tell them differently. If you had to tell them the same way, you wouldn't need to tell them again because you have the original versions. The purpose of what's happening is that Moshe Rabbeinu is saying, okay, we're having a renewal treaty. Just like the Hittites renew their treaty with Azuru because there's a new generation, Moshe Rabbeinu is standing in front of a new generation of Am Yisrael. All the things that Moshe Rabbeinu is recounting at the beginning of Sefer Dvarim that went wrong in the Midbar is the previous generation. And so what Moshe Rabbeinu is doing now is retelling those stories, but with the purpose of signaling to Bnei Yisrael everything that went wrong. It's entirely legit to do this. There's no desire, there's no need to state what happened historically, objectively. The whole purpose is rhetorical. The whole purpose is diplomatic, or if you will, religious signaling from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Am Yisrael. And so the ways in which the stories are told are different, just like the ways in which these stories are told are different. But the fact that they are told differently does not mean that they necessarily stem from a different agenda or different authors. This is from the Hittite court, this is from the Hittite court. It all is one, it's all one continuity over time. And this is the way in which, I would claim, readers of the Torah are meant to engage this. They're meant to notice the differences. The object of the game here is not to play Johnny and the Dyke and smooth out the differences, but to say, there are differences here. Why are there differences here? Why did Moshe Rabbeinu want to tell the stories differently? It's because this is the way in which sovereign kings and the vassal kings at the time signaled to each other. And so the stories are told in a way that's much harsher about Am Yisrael in Sefer Dvarim than it was earlier in the earlier parts of the Torah. That pretty much is all that we have time for, but I think that this is a way, I would claim that this is an example of how there's no way that you can come to this just by sitting in an armchair or sitting in a base medrash. The only way to even begin to think in these terms, the only way to realize that Hakel is based after sovereign kings telling their vassal kings that they need to read the treaty tablet, the only way to come to this material is by getting out there and go east, young man. And I think that there's tremendous potential in this. And I know that there is, if I can turn now to this august audience, and I would say, I know that there is a great fear about engaging in mechkar, and scholarship about the Torah. There's a fear of what that might lead to, what might happen if I do that. And I am telling you, ladies and gentlemen, I'm addressing myself to the younger members of this crowd, jump into the water. I'm telling you, it's not that cold. And I'm telling you that there are new tools out there that are available. I'm not the only one doing this. I'm in touch with a lot of evangelical scholars who've been doing this for a long time, and they do it well. And the academy is much more open to this than it ever was before. There's real potential, and I think that we owe it to ourselves, we owe it to our community, to really engage in this. I'm not claiming that there are magical answers for everything, but I think the situation where, you know, we just sort of put our heads in the sand is having detrimental consequences for our community. And I think that there are ways to begin to think about things. And this is just one small example of it. And I can, anyone that wants to, I'm happy to send the manuscript, which goes at a slower pace than I tried to do here. But I think that there is work to be done. And it's a new type of work, but it's work that requires real commitment over many years to engage in these types of ancient materials. But b'nafshenu, I think that we have no choice. So I hope that they're sitting here, young men and women, who will consider taking this path that requires a tremendous degree of exposure. I mean, you saw international relations are at the heart of what I did here. We have to be very broad and also be very, very deep in the writings and the thinkings of the ancient Near East. And with that, I think that we have a potential to really do a great service for our community. So I want to thank everybody for coming out this afternoon. I'm here forever. Some of you have class 2 minutes ago, and I apologize for that. I'm happy to take any questions once I dismiss everybody, and my best wishes to everybody here for a ketiva v'chatima tova. So those that want to open, go. And any questions? We can. Oh, okay.
I have to run. I have to start teaching very soon.
Good.
Myself.
So much for coming. I was hoping to get to come in and at least wish you a good year and all that. And,
got held up in the meeting. Right. I didn't do the three. So.
Good.
Okay, all the best. Huh? Are you going to be around for a while? Or
no, not so much. I'm really young. I'm in for my parents' 50th anniversary, Blianara. And I'll tap on it, being here or being there. But I think very much about our talk and about the things you write, and I'm really going to do a lot of stuff with it. I'll send you some stuff when I'm ready. I'd love to hear your feedback, okay? Thanks for coming, Barry. Okay.
Thank you very much. I have to run.
Oh, yes, good. Thank you. Oh, and push that button 3 times.